Welcome to the Bible Live Quiz Hour. It's time to test and grow your knowledge of the Bible.
The entire Bible every year.
On Sunday nights at 9, join us here for the Bible Live Quiz Hour. Soapy will ask questions from the Bible Live readings. You call in with the correct answers and you win. It's just that simple. So get out your Bible, put on your thinking cap, and hit that speed dial. Because here's the host of the Bible Live. Your Apache Indian scout through the Book of Books, Soapy Dollar.
Whoopee! It's Sunday, and it's 9 o'clock in the evening, and Stacy and I, my daughter, my lovely daughter, my lovely intelligent daughter.
Thank you. This gets better. Keep going.
Stacy is right here with me, and we're ready tonight to move from the books of Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel. We finished up the book of 2nd Samuel in last week's reading, and we went back and have started now the fourth gospel in the New Testament, the Gospel of John. And it's always, always so much fun. I love the Old Testament. The wonderful things we can learn and wonderful imagery and the lives are such tremendous examples of faith and of not faith, failure and success, and the groundwork is laid for the Messiah. And the Gospels tend to be seen as the culmination of all the Old Testament. It makes sense of it. It all comes together in the Gospels. And we are told, and some have the idea, that the fourth Gospel of John is a culminating, consummating Gospel of the four Gospels. It is gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's deep. It's mysterious. It's everything that that Jesus Christ is and was in human history. And so we're going to close our commentary on Samuel and go into the first nine chapters of the Gospel of John tonight. And Stacy, how do you want to start? What you want to look at a little bit of Samuel first? Or?
Yeah, let's go ahead and finish up in 2 Samuel. Let's see where we leave Israel before jumping ahead.
Okay.
So now, where did we leave Israel?
Samuel was more or less about the first two, the first three kings of Israel.
Right.
Saul, David, and Solomon. Each reigned about 40 years, often known in that 40 years sometimes was partial reigning, and like David, the first 7 years, he only was reigning as king over Judah, the two tribes of Benjamin and Judah. And then after 7 years and a half about that, he was made king over all 12 tribes. But We followed them now, and there's some exciting, wonderful things in them. There are some wonderful failures, very ugly failures on the part of many, even David. So we can learn a lot from their experiences and what we, I think, kind of study that is really helpful in the book of the Samuel and the Kings. You can have biographical studies. Study the life of Saul. Study the life of David. Study the life of Jonathan, their relationship. And then on the women, you can look at Abigail. You could, there are a number of women that we can look at as well and learn a great deal from their lives as well. That's really one of the top features, I think, of the kings is following and learning, seeing the pictures of these men and women as they live their lives here on earth, but with some kind of view of God and some kind of view of their part in God's eternal redemptive plan.
Right.
It makes it very interesting.
Yeah, I think the theme or something that I've, this year, I think I've mentioned it in the past couple of programs, is just the humility factor. And as Solomon, you know, and then before him, David and Saul and Jonathan, like that characteristic of a person that is Godward, that has a sincere relationship and understanding and dependency on God the Creator. I mean, humility is just right at the heart of David. I think especially because, you know, he's a man after God's own heart. And what exactly does that mean? And I think it means it's a heart of just of humility, of love and submission to the ultimate authority, the Creator.
There's another word I like. Humility is fine, good word, but brokenness.
Yeah. There,
God encourages and lifts up the broken, the lowly, those of us who realize we need a Savior desperately, and that we're willing to face up to our sin and our wickedness, our wrong. And I've had so many people surprised, and that may be one of the chief reasons that I've met a number of people who resist the message of the gospel, resist the redemption that's offered to us through Jesus, the Messiah, because of the idea that we have to admit we're sinners. I remember when I was real young, the words, I don't know if you know this, Stacy, but the words to that great hymn, John somebody wrote, the boat of the
Almighty
ship.
Amazing Grace.
How sweet that sounds. That saved a worm like me.
Oh, yeah, instead of a wretch.
When I was young, I'm not sure that had been in the original, knowing the character of that boat captain. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he said that saved a worm like me. But boy, a lot of people that took offense at, oh wait, worm, you know, Yeah, really. And notice we don't sing it that way now.
Well, I think it's wretch now. So
wretch.
Is that better
than
worm?
Well, wretch, worm, wretch. But anyway, the idea of brokenness is, and I've been encouraged that we should not be afraid to live in brokenness, because that's where God focuses His love and His power, His grace. When we are broken, come broken before Him. Anyway, that's you're right. That's part of the one of the great studies that we can make.
And isn't that
the Kings?
Isn't that in the Indiana Jones, isn't that those who kneel before God will pen?
Kneel,
Kneel, indeed, kneel.
The repentant man
shall pass.
Only the repentant shall pass. You know how many times, if you haven't seen Indiana Jones.
Since the Last Crusade, I believe.
Yeah, the Last Crusade. The interesting thing about that movie is the last part of it, whenever they get to the temple where they're searching for the
Searching the Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail, the cup that Christ drank from at Last Supper. That is a real temple.
Oh, yes.
That's a real temple.
In Jordan, right?
Ancient, yeah.
In Petra. Is it Petra?
South of the Dead Sea, down there near where the Qumran documents, the scrolls were found. And it was a real temple, and they used that as a scene
the
of
opening,
the site of the movie.
Did you know, sorry, this is a little, you are listening to the Bible Live.
Yeah.
This is not an Indiana Jones. But I think they also filmed some of that, by the way, in Amarillo, Texas,
really?
If I'm not mistaken.
Now that's very interesting,
interesting
to this Amarillo boy.
I don't know. Maybe I dreamed that and made that up. You have to watch it and go. But it seems like I remember there were
filled a lot of us with hope. That would be great. Amarillo by morning,
up
right?
From San Antonio.
All right. Well, anyway, brokenness, humility, those are all a part of what we see in Samuel. And it ends up, there's still more stories. Saul kills a number of the Gibeonites. Remember the people that they made a treaty with them and promised that they would not kill them. That was a group that fooled the Israelites into thinking they came from a long way off on the journey, but they really from right there, they just didn't want to get wiped out. But the Israelites formed a treaty with them and took a vow that they would not castigate or punish or torture them. Saul broke that vow, and he was held responsible for that. One of the reasons as well that Saul's family and his lineage was cut off. I don't know, is there anything in the last chapters, 20 through 24 or so, Stacey, that there is a listing, you mentioned this last time, a listing of the mighty David's mighty warriors, and I found that intriguing. David clearly was a man's man. He had trouble with women, but boy, he was good with men.
That's probably why he was a man's man, because he had trouble with women.
men followed him, respected him. He was brave, courageous, and so on. I don't think a handsome thing would have mattered that much, but maybe, who knows? But he listed mighty warriors, and it's interesting how many of them were not, or it appeared that were not, Jewish. He had a great number of men, but they were Jewish in the spiritual sense because each had converted, it was following David's God. Even Uriah the Hittite, the one that David committed adultery with his wife and covered up his killing of Uriah. But Uriah was a faithful, loyal
Hittite
follower.
We know that,
And it made David's sin all the more striking, of course. How would you like to be someone who everything your life summed up, the biggest thing you're known for is the two biggest mistakes you made in your life? That's David's situation, I guess.
Yeah. But he was also the golden years. I mean, he was also...
Yeah, that's true.
And that maybe that's says something just in that, known for both his greatest, you know, sins and weakness, his worst moment, but at the same time, that great, you know, that kind of a great years at least for the people.
The golden age, the most wealth, the most
Solomon
power, the influence they had during his reign was it would never equal, and it started its downhill voyage the minute he died, and Solomon took over, and with all his wisdom, you would have thought Solomon could have avoided it, but he didn't. He mm-hmm. didn't for sure. And they started downhill.
Maybe one quick thing, and the census.
Yes.
Can you? I know you've explained this before, but why was this census not okay? And yet in the past, I mean, yeah. there have been cases when they were told to take a census.
They were okay.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that they were never to take a census that God indicated that they should, because men, human beings, were never to be one, never to be reduced to numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one idea. The other is that it caused them to have a false hope and false understanding of the security coming from their strength, mm-hmm. Either their numbers, their economic wealth, or their army.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those were dangerous. Yet there were times when God commanded. This was not one of those. In 2 Samuel 24, he takes a census.
David does, yeah.
Yeah, and the interesting thing there, we talked about it before, and I think it's even a question, if you were given those three options about your punishment for some sin, which one would you have chosen?
Mm-hmm.
And he would have given three options of his own punishment. At the boys' ranch where I grew up, sometimes a dorm parent, I remember one time I got in a fight as a young kid. You have to fight quite a bit, and you have a male-dominated, testosterone-driven culture of 400 boys living on a farm. You're going to fight. Anyway, I was a little young, and I had a fight, I think, with Charles. Not one break. His name was Charles, and he whipped me pretty good. He was 2 years older than me. I should have known better. But anyway, I was told to go out back behind the dorm and choose a branch off of a
right.
bush back there and that they could spank me with. So I chose the littlest, tiniest little band I could find. But they didn't go with that. You know, they went up. That God gave David a choice here.
Right.
And they were tough. What were they?
Right. Famine, war, or disease.
Oh, a famine, war, or a disease of some kind. Wow. Mm-hmm. Which one did he choose?
He went with the disease.
Disease, that's mm-hmm. what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
He killed 70,000 people.
I mean, that'll humble you. Maybe that's
Boy,
why he was so
yeah.
humble.
My goodness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what did that
Of course, he
tell
wouldn't
us?
Have known it was 70,000 unless he counted them. I'm so confused. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I bet he was too. That's good. But yeah, that's interesting.
It is complicated.
To study the relationship between a leader and its people,
mm-hmm.
Or the government, the leadership of a country and their people. There is definitely a relationship, and you could say maybe learn something about it by studying David's choices here. Then there was one other thing. I remember David bought the threshing floor of Ariana. Mm-hmm. I can hardly say that with my stroke. But he bought that threshing floor where, you know what? What mm-hmm. did it mean to thresh wheat maybe some of our listeners won't know what a threshing floor was all about.
Is the threshing floor where they separated the wheat from the chaff right?
They call it. The stems, the cover right. of it, and so on.
And I believe it had to be in a certain kind of look. I mean, just for the sake of, I'm so sorry, protecting like the wind and...
It's usually on a high level where the wind would catch, and they toss right. with a threshing fork, toss the grain in the air, and the wind blows the chaff away while the heavier grains go to the ground, are right. collected and bundled up and sold at the market, I guess. But anyway, he buys that threshing floor, and it becomes the site of
the temple. That is fascinating.
Not only the temple, but the Holy of Holies of the temple, if I remember correctly.
That is very interesting.
I do. That becomes the right. very site of that. And he offered it for free. The guy said, you can have it for free. I'm not.
Right.
And he said, no, I will not offer God something that costs me nothing.
Wow. Oh. Now, see, David.
There's a Bible study for you right there.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else that you saw that might have been?
Oh, well, I'm eager to get to John, so I'm going to say no.
I'll finish with this. I've always been impressed with the role of Nathan in David's life. How courageous. These prophets had to be very brave because they confronted power. They put their bony finger in David's face and said, you're the man. You sinned. And, you know, a king, I guess, with all that power, they would be tempted to...
just do away with him. Nobody else knows.
No one else knows.
But
he didn't do that.
Yeah.
He repented of his sin, and God forgave and restored. It's a wonderful, wonderful way. Well, that's 1 and 2 Samuel, those three kings. We'll get to the rest of the story when we get to 1 and 2 Kings.
Yes.
But I guess we could jump over to John unless you had something else or one of our listeners, maybe something you want to talk about before we leave Samuel entirely.
And I guess maybe we should take this moment. You are listening to the Bible Live, and you can. We are reading. We just this past week finished up 2 Samuel, and we are moving on. We started the book of John, so we're excited. Every Sunday evening, we will talk about the previous week's reading. And so that is what we are doing right now. You can go to thebiblelive.com or biblelive.com and listen to the readings. You are right there on the homepage. You'll have the daily reading, and then by the end of the week, the week's worth of readings.
There are flawless, perfect readings.
If you may say so yourself.
There are pre-stroke. Before my stroke, and I'm so proud. I worked really hard on them through many 6 months overnight, clearly. And
they're great.
You'll enjoy them.
They're so good. And he gives a brief synopsis, you know, just catch you up on where you are in scriptures right before, and then concludes it really beautifully. There's a wisdom and worship reading each segment, each reading as well. And so they're beautiful. He does a fantastic and the schedule is just, I have seen other readings in it, and it's just the calendar of the reading is awesome. It's really fun to go back and forth. I don't think you even meant to do it how it landed, but
really.
It landed just so neat.
Yeah. Well, we were supposed to be, we top it off with a little failure here. Usually at Easter time, we're reading about the resurrection of Jesus in the Gospel of John.
Okay.
We're a little behind this year. But
so it's a little off.
Not the worst thing in the world.
That's so fun, and then if you do want to just binge listen or even catch up or go back, you can find any reading by going to podcast and then programs. And so I needed to pull, for example, a specific verse this past week and put it up on the National Day of Prayer website, which we'll talk about later. And you can go in and find that reading. And so that's, I think, really cool too, and a great resource for people. And so that thebiblelive.com.
What was that verse? Thou shalt attend the National Day of Prayer meeting,
oh, yes.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yes. Oh, First Stacy 2:1:1. I don't know. But we are about to come to our first break, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about National Day of Prayer. That is going to be Thursday, May 4th.
May 2nd.
Is it May 2nd? Sorry about that.
May
2nd. Yeah, I should get that down.
Well, I hope I'm not wrong.
I believe you're right, actually. It is the 2nd. May 4th is Lemonade Day in Bernie. Very random. But let's listen to this music, go to our break, and stay with us. We'll talk about the Gospel of John when we come back on The Bible Live.
Sounds like you and your brothers when y'all were
there. Be gracious unto you. That's right. I don't think there's not much sweeter than children praying and worshiping.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
That's special. Well, welcome back.
You should be come as a child. That's what Jesus said, right?
Mm-hmm. That simplicity, and I think that says something. You're listening to The Bible Live, and we're about to, this past week, we started the book of John. John, and we got through chapter 9. And speaking of simplicity, it is such the book of John.
Yeah.
People have said it's a kind of a more simple, but at the same time, it's one of the most profound and complex. It's such a paradox, which is so very much like a child and like even Jesus's own life, just that paradox. And, you know, you think of the Sermon on the Mount, the poor in spirit will inherit the kingdom of God. Blessed are the first will be last. The last will be first. Just that paradox, you know, that the King, the Almighty, the Creator, born in a manger, you know, or entering into his king on a donkey. And the most powerful, crucified and died on a cross.
Allowed himself to be tortured.
Yes, willingly gave his life, willingly surrendered.
And don't think
himself.
He did. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we get the idea that Jesus was God. It didn't hurt him at all.
Right.
And
we've
already shown you how in John chapter 5, Jesus came. He didn't come to planet Earth to prove. His primary purpose was not to prove he was God.
Right.
Although he did a good job of proving that. But that was not his primary purpose, was to live a perfect, sinless life as a man, mm-hmm. as a real man who grew tired, he grew weary, he felt the blows, he felt mm-hmm. the torture that they put him through.
Mm-hmm.
He was afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And when he sensed death was coming for him as a man, he too was, oh, Father, mm-hmm. three times, Father, is there some way, could this be passed from me?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, not my will, but yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to understand that Jesus' humanity, although John, the focus is in a sense on the evidences that he was indeed God's eternal Son, took on flesh, and he makes a very compelling case, truly. But it's very interesting. One thing I noticed, Stacy, I'm talking too much again, like I often do, but I was reading some material about why John wrote his gospel, you know, who, what, when, where, why, and so on. And there were some theories about it. Some said he wrote the gospel to correct the other gospels, to correct Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Well, that doesn't hold water because his book is very unique to theirs.
And doesn't reference.
He didn't cover the same material as they did. That's one reason they call him the Synoptic Gospel, is he wrote from another point of view from the other gospel writer. Matthew wrote for Jews. Mark wrote for Gentiles. Luke wrote for Gentiles. And Mark wrote for servant.
Right.
And we catch their purpose. But why did John wrote? Well, it wasn't to correct the synoptic gospels, and it wasn't just to correct a wrong view concerning John the Baptist. It wasn't true. There was a heretic back in the days of the early church named Cerinthius, and it wasn't just to refute his writings or what he would do. And then finally, the fourth reason mentioned is John, reason John himself said he wrote the gospel, and that was so you might believe.
But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. He says it, I guess, doesn't
that's
he?
Why he
that's
wrote
why
it.
That's why I wrote these things.
You got to go with that.
Oh, that's so, yeah. Well, John is, I can't remember. I think it was like one point years ago, a Twitter question, you know, if you had to recommend a book to a unbeliever, you know, they've never opened the Bible, what book would you have them read? And this was before I had been joining you for, you know, and have kind of read through it now 3 years, it's going on 3 years. But even then, I said, well, yeah, you got to start with John. It is a common, you know, if you've never read anything, any scriptures, I mean, of course, Romans and, but John, I think, is probably the most often the one that somebody would tell another person who's not a believer, who has no, you know, has not read any of the Bible, to start with the book of John. It is just, it's beautiful. I love this one quote. This was Dr. A.T. Pearson, it touches the heart of Christ. If Matthew corresponds to the court of the Gentiles, John leads us past the veil into the Holy of Holies. There's this really beautiful, I mean, Paul, I love Paul's writings. I love Romans. I love Galatians. I mean, he's Corinthians. I mean, he's wonderful. And I mean, he's great. But there is something, John has a little more of kind of a heart to it. It is, he's not this great student and study, you know, like Paul, he was this incredible, teacher. He was under all of these teachers. He's he's got this brilliant mind. He knows the scriptures. He's, John, you just get this. He was a son of thunder. He knew Jesus. He was Jesus's friend. He walked with. And he writes from that position.
What does he call himself? When John refers to himself in the gospel, Jesus turned to the disciple he loved.
Oh, yeah.
He called himself the disciple Jesus loved. He evidently was youngest of his brothers, and evidently it is thought that John may have been the youngest of the 12, and that Jesus did have, in some way, a special older brother, fatherly, protective kind of view of young John.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he outlives the other disciple up into the 90s.
They think.
But so he was a disciple that Jesus loved, according to him.
Right.
And he knew Jesus' special love for him. He was the one that Jesus turned his mother over him to John, for John to care for her at his crucifixion. There were a lot of endearing, special, really personal signs of the personal relationship between Jesus and John. And that that comes out in the way John writes as well.
Yes. Let's see what we did. You did talk real briefly, and I think most probably the synoptic gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and they're called the synoptic because synonym, synoptic, so they are from that same perspective. They cover a lot of the same things, a lot of you know, different parables that Jesus told, different healings and moments. So those are John is different. There's only one parable in all of the book of John, and it's probably the most theological of all of the gospels. Here I said, you know, he's different than Paul. I think of Paul as the most theological, but John does, he brings in, you know, there's no parables, but he is the author of the I ams. You know, there's a lot of metaphor. Jesus is the bread of life. He's the door. He's the shepherd. He is the, so
good
John uses,
Stacey,
all of these.
You almost got all seven.
I got half of them.
The I am. Yeah.
All of my favorite. Sheep, doors, and bread, evidently. And living water. He's the living water. That's four. Let's see. Five, six, seven.
We didn't read them all in the first
nine
chapters.
Oh, the true vine. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes,
well,
you're right, though. We did not.
We only have about four or five in the first nine chapters.
Oh, then I got all of the ones that we've read.
Yeah, you got it.
But, yeah, John is, it's beautiful. I mean, you'll, of course, famous John 3:16 is in our reading this past week, it's funny, it's kind of interesting that you say, you know, John, we, you know, focusing on, sometimes we think, well, Jesus' life, of course he was able to do that because he was God, right? And I love you focusing on the humanity of Jesus, though, but John, the humanity was very evident. He was his friend, best friend. Like, he saw Jesus. He knew Jesus was human. That wasn't the, and so in his, he writes as though he just found out his best friend is God. I mean, I don't know how to, you know, and he is writing to, he is the Messiah. He is the Son of the Living God. He is Christ. And
Stacy, how would you feel if, in, let's say, this year, all of a sudden, your brothers, I won't.
Which one?
Scott or Sean, either one of them, began to claim that he was the Son of God.
Right. Isn't that crazy? Right.
I'd say, ask anyone, what if your brother, everybody laughs and said, yeah, I'd slap him upside the head, you know, tell him to be quiet. But John and these men lived with him, walked with him, talked with him, and they became convinced. It may have been when he heal the sick and raise the dead and so on, because that was predicted and prophesied. In John's case, I kind of think it was just Jesus, the way he lived, the way he loved God and loved the other people. I kind of think that what would it like to walk and talk with the eternal Son of God? He took on flesh and showed us how humans could live with joy in this world, with all the pain and suffering. And it's amazing thought, really.
Just kind of a sidetrack, but we went and saw, so Will's, my son's school, did a play, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And we went and saw it, and it was a, they did, I thought, a really good job. The adaptation, I mean, that's a tough, I think that's a tough play to do. And anyway, I thought they did it. They didn't, we did not adapt. They purchased the theatrical version. So evidently whoever did do the adaptation and wrote it, good job to them, because it was beautiful. I thought it was very, very good. But I could not help, the most touching part to me was when the professor at the end, this is not from the book really, so they kind of pulled from this, it's maybe hints at it from the book, but the idea that Lucy was very incredibly sad when they ended up back in London, or back in England, you know, so they'd had the Narnia adventures and back in, and at the end, you know, she's goes back and she likes to just lay down in front of the wardrobe and just hope that maybe someday, you know, she'd be back and would get to see Aslan again. And then so the professor kind of comes to comfort her and to, and tells her, I was there too. And I like, and it closes, it's a really sweet kind of, he pulls up a bench and they both just sit in front of the wardrobe together. This old man next to this little girl, and the curtain closes as they're just looking at the wardrobe, kind of anticipating and hoping for that return,
longingly
for Aslan, longingly for his presence and for that. And I it's a little bit of a stretch here maybe, but that must have been what it was like for John and those, in that time. It's almost as if they were in Narnia, you know, when they're with Jesus, and all of these just new, it's like time isn't the same as it used to be. It's as though all of past history is coming to light and an understanding. And you just long you just know you're in the presence of the one who will make all things right. When you're with Aslan, it's going to all be okay.
Now, and when Jesus was crucified and put in the tomb, and the women discovered it, that he had risen from the dead, they went back and told the disciples. Was it Peter and John that went running to the grave?
I'm trying to recall the scene from the Jesus film. I think it is. It's for sure Peter. I think it's Peter and John.
I can't remember. I think John hesitated, and Peter, you know,
right,
of course, Peter, rushed right on
in.
But John was one. He saw the risen Savior. He saw the empty tomb. So that explains some of what turned John's life around. That's a, you can't, I would assume, and you can't really see someone like that and not be affected, would we?
And he was there for the transfiguration. We're jumping ahead a little bit, but John was one of the inner circle. It was Peter, James, and John. So he was there for the transfiguration. He was there at Gethsemane being asked to stay up and pray. He was the inner circle. He was the brother of James, but not the brother who was not, but who was not the half brother of Jesus. This is the different James. Let's see, what else do we know about John?
Well, he wrote, as you know, he lived a long life. He was, as I said, thought to be the youngest, and he was, I've forgotten how he died exactly.
Well, he was exiled to Patmos.
Exiled.
Wrote Revelation. And wrote, then wasn't they thought maybe.
First, second, and third John. Mm-hmm. Three mm-hmm. short letters at the end of the New Testament.
And then, let's see, was he our old age one?
Yes. he was an old age. And he was,
sorry, John.
He was a bishop or a leader or one of the pastors of the church at Ephesus. At some time, I can't think of other, maybe one of our listeners will chime in to help us kind of piece together the life of John.
Okay. Well, let me give him a phone number. If you mm-hmm. are interested, if you'd like to call in, 210-340-9585. We do always love to talk anything through. If you have any questions, if you have any thoughts from one of the readings, we'd love to hear from you. So 210-340-9585. We are here, and there's a phone. So, yeah, give us a call.
You know, it's also interesting that John seems to be, like you said, inner circle. He seemed to have been taken and been present at some of the very special times in Jesus' life and give us a firsthand account of that. I'm thinking of John chapter 3, Jesus' very famous and highly personal and important conversation mm-hmm. with Nicodemus.
Right.
Someone heard and knew what was said.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like John was the one that was either told or mm-hmm. he heard what was said when Jesus had mm-hmm. that nighttime conversation.
Mm-hmm. You do get the sense, maybe this is just because of The Chosen, but I do love, that's one of my favorite episodes of, I haven't actually seen the most recent ones. I think I've only seen the first two seasons, but the way that they depicted John hearing that conversation and then John writing those first couple lines of the book of John. They try to kind of capture him understanding it in real time. So hearing the conversation, and it's just like it sinks from his head to his heart. And you know, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. And just like the light bulb coming on in John's.
Yeah, you know, another characteristic of John's gospel, which I found very interesting, was its simple language. He doesn't use a lot of 4 or 5 syllable words. He uses very simple words, simple understanding, but don't let that fool you into thinking it's shallow.
Right.
He is very profound and deep as well.
Right.
So his simplicity of language, it's one of the features of John as well.
Right. Small words, big concepts.
Yeah.
Abide
in me and I in you.
Right.
Well, take that and chew on it a while. What did that mean?
Right.
Christ in me and I'm in Christ. What? Wow.
John's, so there are not many parables. There's only one parable in the book of John. But he does have, I mean, the story of the Samaritan woman.
Yes.
What are some of the other, Nicodemus, of course, that we talked about.
He tells us what John the Baptist uh-huh. was given a sign to look for so that he would know the Messiah when he met him. And that's how John the Baptist recognized Jesus to be the Messiah, not because he was his second cousin and not because he liked him or something, but because he met God had told him, when you see such a certain thing happen, you'll know that that is the Messiah. And I think that that is a fact that a lot of people miss. And they think Jesus showed up and John just readily recognized, but he would given a sign.
Mm-hmm.
What was that sign? Okay. That's a question I want to ask our listeners. What sign would John the Baptist given as to how he could recognize the Messiah?
I like it. Great question. This is the Bible Live, and if you know the answer to that, 210-340-9585. Let's enjoy this music as we go into our next break, and then we will be back after that.
Lord, you are my beautiful lamb, diamonds, and nothing.
This is Carol Platt Liebau for townhall.com. The California Bar Court has recommended disbarring veteran attorney and constitutional law professor John Eastman. Eastman counseled President Trump on cases dealing with alleged election illegalities on and around January 6th. Many of Eastman's legal arguments are novel, but that's no reason to disbar him. It would be unethical and wrong for Eastman to support ignoring or abrogating the Constitution. But he doesn't. His arguments recognize the Constitution's status as the supreme law of the land. They simply advocate novel interpretations of it. Such advocacy is at the heart of a lawyer's job. It's what Thurgood Marshall did in Brown v. Board of Education, the case that resulted in the desegregation of schools, ending the separate but equal legal doctrine. Disbarring Eastman is wrong. It ultimately jeopardizes the right to effective assistance of counsel, and it's profoundly un-American.
Go to am630theword.com, download our apps, stream us 24/7, or find us at oneplace.com. KSLR San Antonio.
Listen, everybody, because I'm talking to you. Jesus is the only one can carry you through. Now you better get ready, because I'm telling you why. Jesus is the coming from his throne on high. Many are the weary, the lone and sad. They're going to wish they hadn't done the things they had. Now, how you going to feel about when the things he say?
On that judgment day,
I say now,
everybody going to have religion.
You know now,
everybody going to be saying,
all right. I say now. Welcome back. It's the Bible Live. And we're in the book of John.
Our final segment.
Yes. Final segment. We went out on this last time. Dad had a question out there for you all. How was John the Baptist to recognize the Messiah? What sign was John the Baptist told would come about on the Messiah? So how? They were cousins. And surely Elizabeth and Mary did talk. So it is maybe John probably had some thoughts on who it might be, and this was just the confirmation. I'm not sure, but
we don't know much about Jesus' childhood. We have the one incident when he's 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He's completed his 12th year. He's going for his bar mitzvah
in Jerusalem.
At the temple. And he's answering questions from the rabbis and religious leaders, which is something that a young boy does at bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. He asks questions, and they ask questions of him.
So he had gone, born in Bethlehem, fled to Egypt, came back to Bethlehem, lived in Nazareth when he was probably about 3 or 4, or
somewhere around that age.
So then took the road into Jerusalem when he was 12.
Well, he fled down to Egypt probably about when he was about 2.
Right.
All the children under 2 were the ones that Herod had commanded to be killed, trying to eliminate any claim to the throne or a new king, as the Magi had mentioned to him. So they fled into Egypt. They probably lived with the riches, the rich gifts that the Magi had brought them. It's just postulating how they might have lived. Maybe Joseph got a job and so on. But then they come back somewhere 4 to 6 and go to Nazareth. That was their hometown anyway.
So then when he was 12, they took that. And that's the first 12, time he had seen the temple, was in Jerusalem and the temple at 12.
It's the first time it's recorded.
That we know of, Okay. But probably would have been the first time. I don't know. And then left. And the next time he goes into Jerusalem that we know of was his crucifixion.
18 years later. That wasn't the first time he was ever in Jerusalem, I don't believe. When he had been there earlier.
That's right, because we have the account here of him being upset with the money changers and the noise in the court of the Gentiles.
Well, that was during that last week.
That was the last week. Wow, that is in...
Well, much of John...
Yeah, John is
cut. Much of John covers... covered the last week of Jesus' life. That's very interesting, too, about the Gospel of John.
Right. Yeah, because that is in John 2, chapter 2, is the temple and clearing out the...
Wow.
So he gets right that the John is a packed.
Well,
it's
honey,
packed.
I may be wrong. That makes me think I may be wrong that that took place in the... last week,
because that was before Nicodemus. We might need our whiteboard.
yes, for sure. We're straightening it out next week. We'll
have come
our
with the John whiteboard. But it is it is fascinating. Just the life of Jesus and piecing together and remembering. I mean, it was 33 years.
Well, 30 years when he started his ministry with the wedding in Cana.
Which was his first miracle.
Yeah, changing the water into wine. And that was a tremendous moment because here he'd been waiting 18 years. And what was he waiting on? He was waiting on the Father to show him, to indicate to him that it's time now to start your ministry. It's time for you to present yourself to the peoples, to Israel and to the people, with your claim to be the Messiah, the Redeemer, they supposedly have looked for hundreds of years. And so this is, you need to take that stand.
Right.
And Jesus, I assume, was learning, or continued to grow in faith and favor with God and man. And he was growing and growing and understanding not only who he was as Messiah, but he was learning and growing and capturing his role as a Messiah. What was he supposed to do as a Messiah? And that was all revealed in the Scripture. Isaiah, Jeremiah, And the prophets laid out what he would be like, what kind of ministry he would exercise. And so, but there came a time, a moment, when he would have to start making publicly presenting himself and taking his stand. And curiously enough, I tell you, as a mom, it was his mother that would use pivotally into, in a sense, put Jesus out onto the stage.
Yes.
She wasn't rude about it and forceful or whatever. I've always wondered, I wonder why, what? And then I think of a very simple thing. You think of isn't it the seventh command? Obey your mother and father. Honor your father and mother. Mm-hmm. And you will. Here with Jesus. And his mother said, it's time. Uh-huh. You need to do, and told the servant, do whatever he tells you to do.
Yeah. Which I think is also, and you kind of get the feeling that she has seen him do things. You know, she knows. Just obey him. Do whatever he tells you. It's not necessarily as if it is the first time that he's perhaps, but maybe this was the first time that it was public, and to such a for all to see and to
that's what it was.
Be able to participate in
the opening play, the opening move, and not from this time forward. And it created a reaction, of course.
Mm-hmm.
People heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's building his ministry and so on. But at the same time, his enemies heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to work their machinations.
And isn't it interesting, speaking of the enemies and and maybe back to that, the temple, you don't see Jesus. I mean, we know that he has enemies, of course, but you don't see him as angry very much.
No.
And only if he has those strong words for the Pharisees called, the white tombs. And when he has really strong words and anger with the money changing and all of the noise and everything that was happening.
And the religious leaders.
And we know that
there was a scandalous present. One thing when you read the New Testament, especially the Gospels, you have to have in mind that the religious system was broken.
Yes.
There were false priests, and they were selling the priesthood to the highest bidder, and they were not obeying the command of God about the temple, and like you said, you were sharing with me something about the tables that Jesus threw over in the court of the Gentiles,
which would have been one of the only opportunities for a Gentile to be able to come and to hear the reading of scriptures and to even come close to kind of an understanding. And that was always what Israel was called to do, was to be a light to the nations, to be an example to the nations, to help show, to help reach the other nations
to the one true God.
And to bring them in. And yet this was our pastor actually. So thank you, Pastor Novak at Trinity Grace Church. Talked about this a little bit in the last couple of weeks, but Jesus is so angry because they were doing all of this money selling, and there would have been noise and all sorts of distractions, and it would have been in that court of the Gentiles, and it would have been so hard for any person truly seeking and being there and being Godward and to have any kind of a real understanding. So they were keeping people from hearing about God, and that made Jesus angry, that there would be some, that you would be coming between a person who is seeking for God, coming between them and God. And that was, I think that just struck right at the heart of you, the thing you're called to do, which is to bring people to me. You're doing the opposite. You are keeping them from me. And that he was angry with. And I think that's a good, you know, just for, you know, what are, is there anything in my life that is actively, you know, just very blatant, keeping people from coming to, or to hear Jesus, or to see Jesus, or to come to know who God is. And of course, you know, God's bigger than that. There will, you know, he will reach those people, but that's not the point. The point is, though, that I'm called to bring people to him, not to keep them from him. And I thought that was an interesting,
that's a powerful point. Mm-hmm. Truly is. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention in that context, Jesus was indeed angry. And sometimes we think of anger as a sin. And it's important to note that elsewhere in the New Testament, we're told at times to be angry and sin not.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a righteous anger.
Mm-hmm.
And this would an example of that from the life of the Messiah himself.
Mm-hmm. That's so good. Well, speaking of an opportunity to be a light to those that don't know Jesus or that are in darkness, or to share the gospel, to bring people right to the very foot of the throne in prayer, we have the National Day of Prayer coming up. It is the first Thursday of every May. It is, and this year it is on Thursday, May 2nd. It'll be the city's observation. We'll have a mayoral proclamation. We'll be at noon, followed by a time of worship and prayer at Main Plaza downtown in San Antonio. It's just in front of that plaza, that square in front of the San Fernando Cathedral. There's plenty of street parking and a parking lot and a building fairly, you know, all very close by. So it's real easy. It's a wonderful time. First Presbyterian Church downtown also will have a prayer walk starting at 10 a.m. So if you want to meet there, you can actually walk through downtown. You'll go through Travis Park and kind of just and pray over the city as you walk and walk to Main Plaza. And then they'll have a bus that can take you back to your car afterwards if you'd like at any time. Prayer, though, there's a worship and music time that will start at 11:30. So if you want to get there a little bit early and just sit and kind of quietly be able to quietly pray over the city and listen to some worship music, you are more than welcome. There will be a prayer tent if you want to pray with somebody. We will have people there to pray with you. There's also a place to just write your prayers down and place those, and we will have someone pray for you. And there's a tent with Bibles as well. So if you need a Bible for yourself or for family or friends, there will be a place to pick up a free Bible. I think we'll have them in English and in Spanish. There will be chairs and water, so plenty of places to sit, and you don't need to bring waters or pack anything. Just come as you are. So it'll be great. National Day of Prayer.
Our nation is the only nation in the world that has a national day to acknowledge God, to humble ourselves, and seek the Lord, his forgiveness, and his provision for us as a people, as our families, our children, our economy, our military, all areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that you will be joining with millions of American believers across the nation, young people, college-age kids, older folk, but our one unifying factor is that we love God, we believe God is there, and that he is guiding in the affairs of men and nations, and that God responds to those who seek him. He hears us pray and makes a difference in lives and in the culture itself.
Mm-hmm.
So please take out time to pray on the National Day of Prayer. Even if you can't join us for that noon special prayer gathering in the heart of the city, make a day with your family, with the people in your office, mm-hmm. where you're working, at the restaurant, when you go to eat, mm-hmm. remember to pray at your table and pray for our country, our mm-hmm. land. Everybody knows we need it. The
yeah.
only question is, will we pray?
Yeah, yes, that's right. For more information, there is a website, as in National Day of Prayer, so ndpsanantonio.org. And it'll keep you up to date on weather and where we will be inside. We will most likely be outside. But in case of rain, you can go to the website. You can just find out a little bit more. You can see a really great video, actually, the dad that you did on giving the gospel over a lifetime. All My Life is what it's called. And just the importance of sharing the gospel and bringing people to Jesus and through prayer. That is our way. I love back to the book of John. I mean, the Word became flesh. I mean, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we, the power of that Word. I mean, His Word brought creation into being. His Word is the essence of that of wisdom. Jesus was the personification of wisdom, and how much we need that in just navigating this whole life in this world. So, yes, that'd be great. National Day of Prayer. It's always one of my favorite days. This is San Antonio's 39th, I believe.
39 years, San Antonio believers have responded with not only the event, the prayer event. It's not really the National Day of Prayer. It's not actually an event. It's a call for mm-hmm. us as people to pray. And we can pray individually in our homes, in our offices. And that's what God is waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
He's not waiting for an event to impress him with an event.
Mm-hmm.
He's waiting for us to humble ourselves and pray and seek his face. Mm-hmm. As 2 Chronicles 7:14 said, then I will hear from heaven and will heal their land mm-hmm. and forgive their sin. Then when we cry out to him. So remember this very special opportunity
mm-hmm.
that we uniquely have as a country for believers all across the land to seriously seek God's face and
mm-hmm.
turn from our wicked ways
mm-hmm.
and seek him.
Mm-hmm.
He says he'll hear us.
Mm-hmm. That, I guess, back to John.
Yeah.
I don't know why I keep it. But I just love, you know, you mentioned the Amazing Grace, right?
Yeah.
John Newton. I love that. What is it? It's in response to John. It's in John 9. So this was the last chapter of our reading for this past week. And it was him healing the blind man had been born blind. And why they ask, you know, why the blind man was born blind. And he says, so that the power of God could be seen in him when he's healed. And when the blind man is, I just love this. This is my favorite. I don't mean, it's a great quote. When this blind man is questioned by the religious leaders, what one thing did the formerly blind man know for sure? I don't know anything, but I know I was blind and now I see.
It was funny. They were asking him
right.
Theological questions, and on you. Well, I'm not trained, and I don't know
but
anything
I know this.
About that. But one thing I know:
I was blind, but now I see. And that echoes John Newton.
Yeah.
That echoes even when I was, you know, yeah. back to the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and just kind of this There's an understanding. There's a wisdom that walking hand in hand with Jesus gives you in this life. When you don't, I mean, and this, of course, blind man, this was a physical blindness and now he sees. But there's a spiritual too. And when we come to him, we come to Jesus, who is wisdom and is the word, and we ask him, he will open our eyes. I always think of that. This is not in our reading from this past week, but that 7-mile walk, you know, on the road to Emmaus.
Oh, yeah.
That he opened their eyes to the scriptures and their hearts burned within them as he was talking. And he didn't reveal who he was until the very end, you know, I knew it must have been. And their eyes were open to it. And they see the world now through the lens of scriptures, through the lens of who he is. That's the gospel.
Stacey,
that is.
This morning, I told that story to 51 basic trainees at Lackland Aerospace, and 13 of them prayed to receive Christ,
woo-hoo!
To begin their relationship with God through Jesus.
Okay.
And it's just a simple story of God's love and God's care and God solving the central problem of humanity is our sinful, selfish nature.
Mm-hmm.
But he solved it by purchasing our forgiveness and then giving it the Spirit of God to transform our lives and take it out.
And speaking of the Spirit of God, that goes back to the question that we had out there.
Yes,
what was the sign to John the Baptist that this was the Messiah? It was that the Holy Spirit would descend upon him as a dove. And that would be the sign that this is the man marked to be the Messiah. And that is also a mark of a believer today is that we are not alone. Like you always say, those trainees have now their spiritual wingman.
Begun to walk with the Lord.
Yeah.
The journey that lasts forever.
Yeah.
And if you would like to do that tonight, to make a decision, it's simple. It's not profound. There's not a magic formula. But if you say, Lord Jesus, I need you. I open the door of my heart. And I invite you to come into my life and save me, Lord, and change me. Take control of my life and make me the kind of person you want me to be. Jesus said if you would invite him in, he said, I will come in. So make that your prayer tonight.
Amen. Have a wonderful week. It's the Bible Live. The Bible Live is dedicated to helping restore the Bible to our culture. Mailing address is P.O. Box 18888. That's Box 18888. San Antonio, Texas, 78218.
Hear the entire Bible every year on The Bible Live, weeknights at 9:30 on this great station. Then join Soapy every Sunday evening at 9 o'clock for fun, inspiration, and valuable prizes on
The Bible Live Quiz Show.
Visit our website, BibleLive.com. That's BibleLive.com for more information about Soapy and The Bible Live broadcast.
You may also order materials at the website and make tax-deductible donations to help minister to our military personnel and broadcast the entire Bible every year to America and the world.